So, does everyone have the handout that wants one? Okay. All right. Let's take our Bibles and we'll eventually, in due time, get to Genesis 6. It might take me a little bit, but we'll eventually get there. But if you can get your Bibles out at least and turn to Genesis somewhere in those early chapters if you want. But Genesis 6 will be the first specific area that we start to look at tonight. And tonight we're going to be starting, since we finished our other study, we'll be starting the study on, I mentioned Sunday morning, the Noahic Covenant. So we'll start that today, and we'll be in that until we finish it, obviously. So if you get your handout out, I'm going to touch on that in just a moment, and then we'll start our study tonight. Now, I'll go ahead and tell you, tonight's is probably going to be somewhat preparatory. In other words, we'll get a lot of background and all those kinds of things. So in the next week, if you want to read ahead, I know some of you like to be diligent students and get the brownie points from me. They're not necessary, but if you want to read ahead, in all seriousness, and I'll touch on it a little bit, but not really much tonight, read, if you want to, next week. It's on the handout, Genesis chapter 9, verses 1 through 17. That will be where we get to the content of the actual Noahic covenant. We won't get to that point tonight, just too much information, and I don't want to overload you with too much. But what we'll do tonight is somewhat introductory, but what we'll do is I'm going to take the handout, do a brief overview of the handout so you can kind of have an idea of where we're going. You don't have to use this for anything, but at least you'll be able to follow on those Roman numerals sort of where we're headed. And where we're headed is the fifth one that says conclusion. And we'll get to that when we finish. How's that? Okay. So just poking at you a little bit there. Well, if you'd like to, we can. Who knows? Maybe I will begin where we're going to end. All right. But we're going to review the handout, and then we will look at Roman numeral 1, which will be sort of a summary. Obviously, I can't teach through eight chapters of Genesis 8 in a few minutes. Couldn't do it in a few weeks to do justice to it. But I'm going to just sort of summarize it so you can kind of remember when the covenant is given, but also when does God mention he's going to give it. That'll be really what I focus on tonight. But if you look at the handout, we're going to look at the introduction tonight. I'm going to do a summary of the first eight chapters so we can kind of have an idea of when the covenant was given. You'll notice under Roman numeral, the first one there, the second thing being B, starting over after the flood. That'll be what we look at as well. And then if you notice the second Roman numeral, that is the verses that I mentioned where the contents of the covenant are listed. So that's Genesis 9, 1 through 17. But I'm not going to, we won't be looking at the content of it tonight, the guts of it, if you will. But what we will do is, what is a covenant? You may not know what that is. We may not have just, you may already know a lot of this, but we'll look at what is a covenant. We'll see where the Noahic covenant is unconditional. What does that mean? So we're going to say, what is a conditional? What is an unconditional one? And then we'll see where this one is universal. And hopefully when we finish, you'll be able to answer these or at least have an idea or be reminded of them. But let's look at just a basic review of this handout. Mainly I wanted you to have this so you can kind of have an idea where we're trying to get to, or I am. Now, you'll see there, I've noticed, I mentioned I had this one particular verse. It's Genesis 6:18, which is where we'll actually start in a little bit with that particular verse. But I'm just going to read it. It's Genesis 6:18. This is the NASB 95, but they're all translations. Most of them are similar. It says, but I will establish my covenant with you. This is God speaking to Noah. We'll look at this more in just a few minutes when we get there. You shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. So I kind of have that as a starting point, is that God is the one who's going to initiate this covenant with Noah. And that will something we'll look at in just a little bit. But so if you look at the outline, essentially what we're looking at here is sort of an introduction to it. When does this happen? Why is God starting over to begin with? What does that refer to? The Noahic covenant, like I said, we'll look at some questions like, what is a covenant, for instance? And I'll give you a definition of it. We'll see what is the difference between a conditional and an unconditional one. Because later on, if we study, and we will hopefully, if the Lord tarries, the Abrahamic covenant and other covenants along the way, and you need to know what's the difference between a conditional and unconditional one. And then we'll also see where this one is universal, and what does that even mean? Now, when we look at the contents, this is Roman numeral 3. Lord willing, next week we'll look at, and you can see just as a broad view, God's going to tell them to fill the earth. Well, why would they do that? Well, we'll find out tonight if you don't know. They're going to be told, Noah and his family, if you will, his family there, to rule over the animal realm. There's a change in diet. I don't want to dwell on that too much because some of you might not have eaten. But next week we'll look at that. And then we get the interesting one, capital punishment. Okay? Wonder where capital punishment and the debate comes from. Government and all of those fun subjects, we'll look at that. And you are probably asking yourself, Stephen, you're going to talk about it. Well, why not? The Bible does. Why would we be afraid of what the Bible speaks of? And then we're going to see no more global floods. Now, originally I had it as no more floods, but we'll need to clarify that because God doesn't say there wouldn't be a local flood, but a global flood. And then we'll see towards the end of the study that there is this sign of the covenant. And it's not the last time God gives a sign related to a covenant. And a lot of times these covenants, they have signs that are attached to them. What are the signs? What is the purpose of them? And then we will conclude. Where will we conclude? Wherever I finish. How's that, Wanda?
That works.
Okay. Who knows? I might end. Maybe. That's on my printed copy here. You don't get to see all the annotated notes there. And I did put in here, and then we're going to go into the first Roman numeral. I put three different quotes here. You can read them on your own. I will probably refer to one of them next time. But you can just read those quotes, and they're really just to sort of try to fill in some things. If you're not familiar with it, it'll maybe start to kind of click. So the first one is from Constable's Expository Notes. The next one is from the Ryrie Study Bible. Amen? All right. Ryrie, it's the way to go. The best study Bible there was ever was. All right. Hey, look, I'm the one teaching. So when it's your turn, you can. Yep. All right. But it is a helpful quote. But then down at the bottom here, the third one, I encourage you to read these as you have time. Henry Morris makes a quote on related to it in his commentary, The Genesis Record. So just read those if you have time, and I'll probably reference them over the coming studies. But let's start with Roman numeral 1, and we're going to look at a summary of Genesis 1 through 8, and then we'll look at starting over after the flood. Why would they need to start over after the flood beyond the obvious? But let's try to do this because, and you might be thinking, why do this? Because the covenant is given in Genesis 9. We need to understand sort of the background, and I'm not suggesting you don't know the first chapters of Genesis. But let me just kind of give a summary of them, and you can see when, though, the actual covenant is told of Noah that he will be given it, because it's before the flood. The flood follows, and then God gives the actual covenant, which is actually an interesting point. But if I were going to give a summary, this is the way I would say it. The first three chapters of Genesis, again, you probably know this. I'm not suggesting you don't. But we need to make sure we read things in the context. So the first three chapters, what I would tell you is it's the week of creation. God begins by, of course, establishing that week of creation. He creates everything. And the week ends there, if you will. And you have chapter 2. I take chapter 2 to be the detailed version of the sixth day. In other words, it's almost like you've probably heard me use this expression. It's like Moses wrote the first chapter and then he says, wait a minute, God, could you explain to me in more detail how the creation of man happened? That's just the way I think of it. So it's sort of parenthetical. He pauses, he describes in detail the sixth day. But then chapter 3 comes, and we all probably are familiar with chapter 3. The chapter 3 is the fall of man and all of creation. Okay? Let me clarify that because, you know, we do tend to focus on the fact, and I understand why, that is where we have the fall of man. Sin enters into the picture. But don't forget, as Paul will say later in Romans, all of creation was affected by the fall, okay? And if you want to answer a lot of the quandaries and problems we have in life, you can go back there, because that's why we have some of the problems we have in nature and so forth. So the first three chapters are basically the creation account, the detailed description of the sixth day, and then the fall of everything. Fall of man, but you get the point. And then when you get to Genesis 4 through 5, God, in a sense, he kicks Adam and Eve, as we like to call it, out of the garden. But things don't improve, do they? Man's condition, in fact, gets worse. I think of it as it doesn't take long for sin to spread. Actually, it's right out in chapter 4. You have murder, and you just have this picture of deterioration. I call it, it's the deterioration and the corruption of man described in detail. So you have Adam and Eve, they come out of the garden, and then in chapter 4 and 5, you just have this ongoing deterioration of humanity. And then eventually what happens is God gets to the point where he needs to bring judgment on the earth. Okay, so I'm summarizing that because that's the background for the covenant. If you just drop into the covenant, a lot of it's not going to make sense. So why would God do this? I mean, and we have the answers with the judgment. So God, of course, in chapters 4 and 5, you see the progression or the descending of corruption on the earth. And then God sends the flood. In the flood account, and if you want to read it, you can read Genesis 6 through chapter 8. It does sort of subside, of course, in chapter 8. But if you wanted to, just for background purposes, that's the detail of that flood, how long it takes and all the details with it. Now, if you are in Genesis at this point, we see where God, of course, has seen where there's so much corruption that God's going to judge the earth. And in Genesis 8, I want us just to sort of look at these verses. I'm going to just read them for time's sake. But so Genesis 6 through 8 is the flood account, the detail of the flood. But look with me in Genesis 6, because I just want us to conceptualize what precedes not only the covenant, but God giving the idea, I'm going to give a covenant. God doesn't just all of a sudden, when they get off the ark, say, you know what, it's a good idea to give a covenant. There's something that precedes it, and that's God's promise of several factors. But let's look at, if you have your Bibles, Genesis 6, 7 through 8. So God has been grieved in his heart. He sees the corruption of all of creation. Judgment is going to come on his, if you will, marred creation, maybe is the way to say it. But I just want you to get the grasp of this. So look at verse 7 and 8. The Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to the birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. So you see the totality of judgment is what? Everything, in short. But notice here, but Noah in verse 8 found favor in the eyes of the Lord. You study the Hebrew, it gives the idea of grace. God looked down and he saw grace and had favor upon the one man, Noah, which is setting the stage for what we'll look at over the next week or two. Now, I want someone, though, to look with me, though, as you see here in verses 12 through 17 of chapter 6. God, of course, he sees in verse 12, the earth is corrupt. So this is a sort of, I don't want to call it a recapitulation, but he's basically going back and saying the earth is corrupt. But then he tells Noah, the end of all flesh, I'm about to destroy everything. And then he's going to make the ark, and he gives some of the details there. And then he says, I'm getting ready to bring the flood upon the earth, verse 17, and that everything that is on the earth shall perish, of course, except for whatever is on that ark. Okay? So if we just stop here, the background is pretty simple, isn't it? I mean, in a general sense, God created everything. Sin enters into creation and it corrupts everything, not only man, but all of creation. You see this downward spiral of humanity. God has to bring some type of judgment to stop it for various reasons. God's way of doing it is going to be a universal flood that will flood everything. And all that is saved is, of course, whatever is there on the ark in brevity form. But you might be thinking to yourself, that, okay, so God's going to do this and he's going to bring them through and then they're going to get off the ark and then God decides he's going to make a promise or covenant, and that wouldn't be the case. I want someone to read here because this is really important, because after the flood subsides, which is what we're going to look at in just a minute, Noah's going to do something, but I want us to make sure we remember something. God promises the covenant before the flood comes. So I'm going to read verse 18. This is something I've already read once, but now having said all of that, someone read Genesis 6, verse 18, because before Noah gets into the ark, notice what God says. Okay, Gene, go ahead.
"And I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife, and your sons' wives with you."
All right, thank you. So this is the first time the word covenant is used in the Bible. Now, the idea of covenants are seen earlier, for instance, with Adam, but this is the first time, don't misunderstand what I'm saying, the first time the actual word is used here in the Bible is when it's made here. Now, if you notice as well, has the flood happened yet?
Mm-mm. No.
So try to visualize in your mind, Noah's been given instructions, everything's going to be destroyed except for what's going to be on the ark. I'm going to make a covenant with you and your family. Now, how would he do that and why would God do that if Noah's not going to make it and survive the flood? Of course, I'm being a little bit rhetorical here. The idea that I want you to see here is that the Lord promises before the flood comes that he's going to make a covenant with Noah and his family, which implies what? Yeah, they're going to make it and they're going to survive. I'm not suggesting. Did you have a comment?
Question.
Yeah, go ahead. Is that idea, because it's interesting that he would promise that before the flood. And you would think, why would that make any difference? But I think it would have reassured Noah that he was going to be brought through it. Imagine being on the ark for all of that period of time. You'd have to be terrified, because there's no way he would have fully understood what that type of judgment is, because God had never brought it on the earth before. But if you knew in the back of your mind, God was going to somehow bring me through this and establish whatever this was with me, that would definitely reassure him. Now, having said that, and I want to point that out because I don't want us to miss that, because Noah does not just pop off the ark and God had this idea in his mind. He had already promised it beforehand. And I think I would argue probably he learns what that is here, doesn't he? But let's look here, because they're going to start over. So obviously you know why they have to start over, because there's nothing left by and large. I mean, when God judges, he does it very swiftly and completely. But let's look at, now having said all that, let's look at Genesis 8 verses 14 through 23. Now that is where the Lord begins to, if you will, end the flood. So if you want to read those preceding verses from Genesis 6, 18 to about that section there in verse 14, you begin to see where, and I'm doing some of this just for time's sake, you can read those, but it begins to get where the flood subsides and Noah's going to exit the ark and Noah and his family. But it's curious to me, and again, I'd point you to read it here in verse 18. So Noah went out and his sons, this is Genesis 8, 18, and his wives and his sons' wives with him and all the beasts and so forth. But what is the first thing Noah does? I mean, I'm sure the first thing he's going to do is what? Focus on himself? All right, somebody read it for me. Someone read verse 20 for me.
"And Noah built an altar unto the Lord, and took of every clean beast, and of every clean fowl, and offered burnt offerings on the altar."
Yeah, it's interesting to me. The first thing he does is he worships and sacrifices to God. So the flood's coming. God says, I'm going to deliver just you and your family and the contents of the ark, all those giraffes and all of those dinosaurs and all of that stuff. But you're also going to survive it. I'm going to establish this covenant with you. And then when he gets off, Noah's first thing is to worship God and to offer this sacrifice to him. I'm going to read you this from, it's from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. And it just drives home the particular point I want you to think about here. It says, "The people of God are worshiping people, And that worship was to take the form of giving God some of the best of what was his. Noah received grace, walked with God in obedience and righteousness, was preserved from judgment, and his first response was to worship and sacrifice to God. I want you to think here. He did not stop and say how great that ark is. He didn't turn and worship the ark, did he? He worshiped God. That's really important, though, because the tendency might be thinking, well, you know, I mean, I'm sure he's grateful for the ark. But his first response was to worship God. And it's such a beautiful picture there that Noah doesn't worship the ark, but the God, of course, who delivered him through that as well. Now, look at, if you will, so that's just sort of an introduction because I want you to just have a basic idea. The flood has come. Before it, God promised a covenant. And to your point, whether he understood that or not, probably not at the time, but he will whenever we finish these verses in chapter 9. And Noah's first thing is to worship God rather than the ark. Now, in Roman numeral 2 that I have on the handout there, and again, you can use this later on if you want to delve into it a little bit more. If I don't cover everything by the time we finish in the upcoming weeks, but you'll notice the ark, the covenant itself, I have it there for you. You'll find the contents and all of it there. It's in Genesis 9, 1 through 17. And so they leave the ark. God is worshipped there. Sacrifice occurs. The focus is on God as the one who delivered him. But I thought the question I want to get to is these few that I have on this list is the first one, what is a covenant? I probably know in your mind, you at least kind of have an idea. Some interpreters like to use this basic idea, but I'm going to read a full definition of it for you. And if this helps, if you have trouble with a covenant, think of a promise. I don't think that that's strong enough, but it does give sort of the idea, okay? Sort of meaning, not exactly. The idea that God promises to do something for X. Okay, but let me read this to you. What is a covenant? A covenant is a promise between two or more parties to perform certain actions. A covenant was a well-known concept in ancient times, and covenants could be made between two equal parties or between a king and a subject. The king would promise certain protections, and the subject would promise loyalty to the king. A covenant, but notice this, a covenant might be conditional or unconditional, which is the key, okay? Because the Noahic covenant is fairly straightforward. Some of the other ones can get a little bit more complicated. Now, have you ever heard the terms unconditional and conditional covenant before?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. If you haven't, I thought this would help a little bit. So the Bible has two types of covenants, okay? So you go through these biblical covenants, and you say, what is a biblical covenant? I reference them all the time. Not the Noahic one, I don't, but the Abrahamic one and the Davidic one. Those two are paramount. If you don't understand those, at least to a basic level, honestly, the Old Testament and the coming of Jesus probably don't make a lot of sense. I think there's a lot of gaps there. But the types of covenant God makes is two types. Noah's, we'll see, is what's called unconditional, okay? It's an unconditional covenant, and essentially what it means is that it does not depend on anything that Noah or his descendants need to do or are responsible to do. Now, I want you to think about this, especially when we look at the contents of the covenant next week. Imagine sacrificing to God. God says, go be fruitful and multiply, which is what we'll look at next week. Repeating the promise or the condition given in command to Adam. And then the first storm comes. The first rain or storm comes. What do you might be thinking? What if we die?
What have I got myself into?
Yes. Or to Wanda's point, articulating it, what have I gotten myself into? I should have just gone ahead and gone down earlier. Think about that when we start thinking of this covenant, because it shows the grace and the mercy of God like many others don't necessarily in this way, because the natural tendency would be to be afraid, and God's going to keep that. So what is a conditional covenant? I'm going to read you this. This comes from Walvoord and Lewis Ferry Chaper's book, Bible Themes, which is a great book if you don't have it. It says, quote, a conditional covenant is one in which God's actions in a response to some action on part of those to whom the covenant is addressed. A conditional covenant guarantees that God will do his part with absolute certainty when the human requirements are met. But if man fails, God is not obligated to fulfill his covenant. So it's basically just what it says. It has conditions to it. It would be like me saying, I promise to do this for Dave, but Dave on his part must do this. If Dave or either party breaks it, I'm not obligated to do it. That would be a simple way to think of it. So unconditional is pretty much the opposite. Okay, what is that? Well, an unconditional covenant, while it may contain certain human contingencies, is a declaration of a certain purpose of God, and the promises of an unconditional covenant will be certainly fulfilled in God's time and in God's ways. In other words, it's not based on something that someone does. Noah and his descendants don't have to do anything to keep God from flooding the earth again. It's not based on them. They don't have any merit or any worth in them. God does it of his own accord. He says, I am graciously going to offer this covenant. And the covenant doesn't matter. Even if you sin to the hills, I'm still going to fulfill my covenant. Okay? So when we look at this, we see a covenant. What it is a promise between two parties. It can be either based on conditions that need to be met, or they can be unconditional. But I want us to look at one thing before we finish, and then I'll draw us to a close for this week. But look with me in Genesis 9, and we're going to look at the last piece of Roman numeral 2. Because this covenant is what's called universal, okay? So it's universal versus what will be not specific for a particular person or a nation or something of that nature. In other words, it does have just that. It's universal in its scope. It's not a, if you will, Davidic covenant would be specific to the Davidic line, if you want to think of it that way. This one is universal. Let me read the verses for you and see where it says this. So this is Genesis 9, 9 through 10. Now behold, I myself do establish the covenant with you. So who's making the covenant? God, and he's making it with Noah and his descendants. God is the initiator of this covenant. I think there's a heavy element of grace and mercy here, because again, imagine the flood, the next storm that comes along. I mean, you'd probably be scared to death. No pun intended. But look at verse 10. But so he's making it with you and your descendants after you. So those descendants that come from Noah, where do you and I come from? I can pretty much tell you, I don't know who your parents are, but I can pretty much guarantee I could go back to Noah and say that somewhere along the daisy chain, you connect back there. So you understand that's the idea of universality here. But notice verse 10, though, because the covenant isn't simply made with the human aspect there. It says, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth. So very simply put, the covenant that we look at, the contents next time, we'll start looking at them. God is making it universally. It's to all the human descendants of this earth. It's with all of the animal realm. Now, what is the big deal? Because when we get to subjects like capital punishment and these types of things, you'll see where it has a universal aspect to it. Okay? So just keep in mind, when we look at this covenant, it's universal and it covers everything. It's not for a specific person or a nation, if you will, like some of the other covenants. So I want us to look at something here just real quick. I'm going to read you something. But when Noah left the ark, after the flood, the first thing we know he did, I focused on it a lot because I find it interesting, is he worships and he sacrifices. That's the very first thing he does. Why would he do that? Well, there's a lot of reasons why, but I think one of the main ones is he knows the one who delivered him was the Lord. It was the Lord who sustained him and brought him through that. I'm going to read you something here, and then I wanted to leave some time in case I didn't clarify something or you have questions. But this comes from C.H. McIntosh. If you don't know, he's probably one of my favorite authors from a bygone era, unfortunately. But anyway, notice what he writes about this. He says, and this is the idea of Noah coming off and offering this sacrifice. McIntosh says, Noah's faith passed beyond the ark to the God of the ark. And when he stepped out of it, instead of casting back a lingering look at it or regarding it as an object of worship, he built an altar to the Lord and worshiped him, and the ark is never heard of again. The reason why I find that fascinating is because it's the God of the ark that is worshiped. And, you know, I've often wondered, it's probably just as well that we don't know where the ark is, or we don't know where Moses is, because man's tendency is to worship something. And what does Noah worship? The only one true God, and so forth. So it's just something interesting.